You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There were lots of so-called graffiti artists covering what seemed like every available space in New York during the 1970s. But when someone calling himself Samo appeared on the scene, people in the art world took notice. A few years later, he began to paint on canvas, and by 1983, he was an artist with a major international reputation. And then 3 years later, he was dead of a drug overdose. It's the story of the meteoric career of Jean-Michel Basquiat, which Tamara Davis chronicles in her documentary, Jean-Michel Basquiat, The Radiant Child. It opens at Film Forum today and runs through August 3rd, and I'm very pleased that it brings Tamara Davis to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Didn't you shoot much of the footage in this film yourself in the 80s?
I did. I shot most of, in fact, pretty much all the footage of Jean-Michel painting. So all those images of him painting or dancing or kind of all those like Super 8 kind of images I filmed. And then we did a formal interview in, I think it's 86 is when it states. And that was also in, all that footage was from Los Angeles. And I think there were different times that I came to New York and I always had cameras with me. So I happened to have like a bit of stock footage of New York at the time. But the film also, I'm so grateful for all the archival footage and also all the photographs that appear in the movie.
Were you shooting other artists as well? Or was there something about Jean-Michel that attracted you?
Definitely something about Jean-Michel that attracted me. I was just, at that time, I was just making a film about Jean-Michel. Yeah, I was going to film school and he suggested I should make a movie about him. And I think it was a way for us to hang out more and be in the studio with him painting. And he was pretty much my subject.
So why is it taking you nearly 25 years to make a film?
I know. When he died, I got so upset and so sad about it. And he was also, when he passed through Los Angeles on the way, he expressed to me that he was really sad that so many of his friends that he had given gifts to or paintings had turned around and sold them. And somehow I felt that the footage that he gave me was a gift. And so I just kind of put it away for a while because I just felt like it wasn't the right time.
And making money on him, especially after he died.
Yeah, like I felt like why I shouldn't really be ghoulish. Yeah, so I put it away. And it wasn't until I talked to some of the people, some friends of mine from MoCA when they were doing the retrospective that I realized, and I showed it to them, that how rare and amazing this footage was and that it didn't just belong in my drawer and that it was a very valuable piece of history.
Well, his story sounds like the plot of many novels. A young and talented artist is overwhelmed and eaten alive by sudden fame. Is there something about his story that makes it unique?
I think that was part of what I liked about it is that it did fit a classical narrative. And so I think that is really something that we can hold on to as actual cinema and filmmaking. What I think makes his story unique is I think it also brings in New York City at a time when it was really, you know, a cultural revolution in a sense, and bringing in most of the art that we and music that we have now today comes from that time. And then also that we're dealing with somebody that looks different, that he was Haitian and Puerto Rican. He passed as an African-American. So, I think that I definitely deal with racism in the film.
Well, he comes out of an interesting family background. Since he was a homeless kid at 17, people, I'm sure, assumed at the time that he escaped poverty. But he actually escaped rather comfortable living circumstances.
No, he escaped his middle-class background. And his
father was a businessman, successful businessman.
Yeah, his father was an accountant. Yeah, so, you know, with all the talk about how Jean-Michel would, like, stuff his money places, he knew very well the value of money. And I think, in a way, he was rebelling against that.
He had a reputation for being a kind of a wild child, a primitive. The fact of the matter is that he was anything but.
I know. I think that was one of the main things that I was really trying to show in my film was that he was incredibly intellectual and he knew about all different kinds of art and music and film. And he was so passionate about the things that he would get excited about. And we see those clues over and over in his art. You can see that he's reading, you know, Burroughs and Darwin and, you know, looking at Leonardo da Vinci. You know, all the things that he's studying just appears right on the canvas.
Well, how does this happen? Because he is rather sophisticated. And even if you grow up in a sophisticated home, If you don't go to art school, there are certain things that are hard to learn by yourself. I mean, he's not a primitive.
No, you know what he was? He was some. He had the ability that when he got interested in something, he would just consume it and love it to such an extent. So whether it was jazz or wine or a person, he just completely engulfed it and embraced it and enjoyed it.
And although he was very young, he associated with a lot of famous people older than he. He was really close in his later years to Andy Warhol in what almost comes across as a father-son relationship.
Yeah, I kind of explore that a bit in the film because I really felt that a lot of what Jean-Michel, what his drive was, is I felt sometimes that he was trying to get the respect of his father. And so when he finally befriends Andy Warhol and starts this relationship with Andy, it's very much a father-son relationship. And I tried to make that very clear. And I feel that when Andy embraced him and kind of helped him, I feel that he really, you know, continued and got that respect from somebody that he really wanted it from.
Well, he went from being a homeless kid to a major celebrity that people wanted to meet. How did he become connected or involved with Madonna?
That was so fascinating as everybody was hanging around at that time. And I think that if you were a young club kid, you know, going to Mud Club and all, you know, Tier 3 and all those places, she was out there too, as just as ambitious as he was. I found that they had a lot of similarities. They were so determined to become number one. And, you know, that was something I thought was very important to show, that Jean-Michel wasn't this laissez-faire kind of stumbling into it. Like, he really was ambitious and he wanted to be number one.
I'm talking with Tamara Davis, whose film Jean-Michel Basquiat, The Radiant Child, opens at the Film Forum today and runs through August 3rd. Why The Radiant Child?
It's such a beautiful line. It's from a René Ricard article. And if you met Jean-Michel, he radiated. He was somebody that when he walked into a room, every head would turn. And just his smile is so radiant. And then I also really love to refer to him as a child because even I don't know anybody who has that ability to have fun like he did. I mean, the only people I can really relate that to is my child. And so, I think that also the way he drew and was very childish. So I love calling him a child, and I think he would have liked it too.
Were his parents supportive of his artistic pursuits?
I think that they weren't at first. Maybe his mom was, but I think the father really, you know, he's a Haitian businessman. I think that he worked really hard to get to where he was, and I think he wanted a son that continued with that kind of formality. And so when you have a son that is rebelling against that and is kind of going opposite of that, I think it was very difficult for the father. And, you know, I think that once he became more and more famous and got more and more established, I think the father really did see the value in this.
It's one thing to rebel. It's another thing to leave home at 17 and live on the streets as a homeless person.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he had like this kind of romanticism about it. You know, Jean-Michel was reading Kerouac and Burroughs. And, you know, when you find that scene that existed downtown New York at that time, it was possible. You know, you really could live door to door and girlfriend to girlfriend.
In Soho and the Lower East Side. In today's art climate, wouldn't it be a lot more difficult for someone to gain recognition the way that he did? Graffiti is not taken seriously much anymore.
I guess so. I mean, but there are people like Shepard Fairey or Banksy that have definitely started out on the street and have turned somehow what they've done on the street into art. So, you know, I do think it's possible, but I think that, you know, each time in our culture, it's hard to know what's going to stick until you really can look back.
Although today it would be in Williamsburg, Greenpoint, Long Island City, places like that. And the scene is very different than it was then. It was much more focused in one or two neighborhoods then.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that also there was a scene where it wasn't just art, it was also music and film, and you did each one of those things.
And when he was young, he joined a band even though he couldn't play an instrument, and everybody said, wow, that's wild.
Yeah, I mean, he was
almost too accepting at the time.
Yeah, but I think it was pretty interesting. I use a lot of the Gray, the music from his band Gray, in the soundtrack, and it was amazing. And I love that I have Thurston Moore describing the sounds that Jean-Michel was making, because Thurston Moore makes that kind of music now.
He made his first big splash as the graffiti artist known as Samo, and I would ask you what Samo means, except that we have the FCC to worry about. Can you give us the cleaned up version?
Same old stuff.
Okay. Now, what was he doing that distinguished him from all those other graffiti artists?
I really wanted to make a point of that because I felt that he was titled a graffiti artist so much. And a classical graffiti artist was somebody that wrote their name, and they wrote their name all over the trains or all over the city. And Jean-Michel and the group that was Samo at the time, they really were right in Soho. They were right outside the gallery doors. And they weren't just writing their names. They were writing these beautiful poetic statements. And I was able to find this man, Henry Flint, that didn't know anything about Basquiat, but took all these beautiful photographs at that time. And a lot of the photographs of Samo came from Henry Flint.
Did he, once he started making it, some people complained that he was kind of marketed as a natural, a wild child. There were rumors that a gallery owner had locked him in her basement and just forced him to paint, which, of course, was not true. But all of that led to some people being rather suspicious about this as really not as much about art as about taking advantage of the scene and the taking advantage of feelings about African-Americans as natural artists. You mentioned racism before. How much of that do you think played a part in his becoming so famous so quickly?
I think that he definitely battled with that, but he also embraced it. I think there were certain times that he knew that being a wild child would get him attention. And then I think there were certain times that he felt really offended by somebody looking at him in a certain way. And I definitely go into those aspects in the film. And, you know, just for myself and for a lot of the people, especially Anina Nose, it was very important to me to kind of clarify some of those myths and, you know, no, he was not locked in the basement. And she fed him drugs or something. You know, she's a very respectable woman, and you know, that was a beautiful basement that he stayed in.
Actually, she helped him develop as an artist.
Yeah.
When did Basquiat start using drugs? Cocaine was the drug of choice in that scene at the time, but he was also using heroin.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I didn't really know. I was from Los Angeles, and I didn't do those kinds of drugs, and I think that that's like a secret world if you do those kinds of drugs. So I didn't really know that he was doing that or that he had a problem with it. And in fact, not until the very end when he really was like, I'm clean and don't drive me by okie dogs, you know, like don't drive me by places where I know I can score. And I really saw like, oh, my God, this is really a problem for him.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned you shot the interview. He had serious drug problems at that point in Los Angeles. Even though he is so New York, he spent much of his later time trying to escape New York, going to Hawaii, where he lived for a while, going to L.A., but always came back.
Yeah, I mean, New York was his home. I think that he really identified with this place, but it also meant certain things to him. And I think that those were things that he had a hard time confronting. And, you know, to me, when he was in Los Angeles, I think that he would call somebody like myself, who's a very healthy, happy person who likes to have fun. And it's a distraction from that kind of dark New York feeling.
This isn't the first film about Basquiat. In 1996, Julian Schnabel directed a film based on his life. In looking at the Schnabel film, Schnabel appears in your film,
yeah.
So I'm sure you don't want to say anything negative. But do you think that he left out certain things, missed something about Basquiat?
I mean, I think that it's always difficult to make a movie about somebody where the people who are still alive knew the person. So that's always going to be hard. And I watched the film when it came out, but I definitely didn't watch it again when I started to make this film. And there was when I interviewed Peter Brandt, Peter Brandt said, Tamara, don't worry about that movie. That movie's not about Jean-Michel Basquiat. It's about Julian Schnabel. And just a big sigh of relief came over me because I realized that although I believe that Julian's an incredible filmmaker, it wasn't the Jean-Michel that I knew, but it was Julian's world. And I feel that that's very respectable.
Well, they, of course, contributed to that. The estate prohibited Schnabel from using any of Basquiat's actual paintings in the film.
Yeah.
You didn't have that problem.
No, Julian painted all the Basquiats, and that was like a big thing for me. In order to make my film, I had to get the approval from the father, and that was huge. So I was very grateful that the father trusted me.
How did he die? Could it have been prevented?
I think any death at, 27 of a drug overdose can be prevented. So, yes, it definitely could have been prevented. We all take our own responsibilities. For myself, I feel like, oh, my God, if I could have just left my husband and spent that time nursing Jean-Michel back to life or, back to, being okay, that would have been great. Or I wish rehab places existed at that time.
Well, he was in decline at the time and rather depressed.
Yeah.
His career was not going well. And then he died and suddenly the paintings are selling for millions of dollars.
Yeah. I mean, right after he died, people just kind of unloaded the paintings. They thought that was a flash in the pan and it was off. And in fact, it was Julian Schnabel's movie actually was one of the things that if you look at the scale of when the art starts to come back and a few of the collectors really started to really promote Jean-Michel. And it's crazy if you think that one of his paintings could sell between, $14, $20 million for one painting. That's just insanity to me.
Well, no matter what you think of his work, just watching him and seeing what New York was like at the time makes this film quite fascinating. I was surprised to learn just how bright Jean-Michel Basquiat actually was, because there was no way I could know just seeing him as part of that scene during the 80s. And I want to thank you so much for coming by to talk about it. And the film is Jean-Michel Basquiat, The Radiant Child. It opens at the Film Forum today, runs through August 3rd, made by Tamara Davis.
Thank you very much.